This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, April 26th. This is our local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff. We'll speak with Thomas Humphrey at the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll check in with Paul Benson at the Provincetown Independent and Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current. CAI's Dan Treidle will speak with our State House reporter Katie Lannon, and we'll hear from Grace Ferguson of the New Bedford Light. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. We could be driving across a new Sagamore Bridge by 2034 and over a new Bourne Bridge a year later. It's one of the takeaways from a public meeting last night that provided updates on the replacement of the canal bridges. CAI's Jeanette Barnes has been covering the story and joins us now. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
This was the first public meeting on the bridges in about a year. Describe it for us. Who was there? How was it run?
Sure. It was run by the project manager for the bridges. That's Brian Cordero from the State Department of Transportation. Most of the other speakers, as in the past, were from the design firm that is consulting with the state in this planning stage. That company's called HNTB. And the meeting was online with no in-person component. It was run kind of like a webinar. So I couldn't see who was in the audience. But the state did allow plenty of questions. They had a number of visuals showing a little more refined drawing of the bridge concept. They had a drawing of the bike and pedestrian path and how it's going to be separated from the vehicles. This is still not considered the final design, though, and the design actually won't be final according to their schedule for a few years yet. Aside from that, they talked about the major steps going forward that need to happen before the bridges can be built and the timeline for all of that.
One high-level takeaway that I mentioned at the top, a new Sagamore Bridge by 2034, so 10 years from now, perhaps the Bourne done by the next year. The state was floating out there already, I guess, but this is the first time that we've heard a number of details about how we get there, what the timeline looks like to bring us to 2034. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. The state did target a 2034 opening date a couple of years ago, but originally it was heavily dependent on funding that had not been committed yet. So now the state is saying, yes, we have the money to go full speed ahead, certainly on the Sagamore, but really on both, because they say the dates for the Bourne Bridge will only be about a year behind the comparable dates for the Sagamore. One of the really important things that's coming up will be a draft of the environmental impact statement. That's a comprehensive document that the state says will answer a lot of the questions people have had about this project, about things like, you know, if traffic moves more smoothly over the bridges, will there be more cars coming to Cape Cod? What are some of the other issues for the wider community? And that draft, which is a sort of part of the federal environmental review, that should be published in about a year. It covers both bridges. And then they revealed some other things, new things on the timeline, too. The state expects to have a draft of the request for proposals by the fall of 2026. Those are the documents that the design build contractors would have to respond to in order to bid. And then once the state chooses a contractor, they expect to give the final green light for the contractor to start work in the winter of 2027.
Let's talk about the money. You mentioned that there at the beginning of that a little bit ago, but where is the money going to come from? That's been one of the biggest questions so far. It doesn't sound like this is something that these officials are hung up on.
No, they seem very comfortable with what they have so far. That's right. For one thing, we know that when Governor Healey pledged that $700 million for the bridges over the long term, only part of it is in the capital plan right now, but Cordero from DOT says that the governor's full commitment of the $700 million right now is, he said, secure and available to use. So that actually makes the math work a lot better. If they also get this big federal grant they're waiting to hear about, then they are not just near the total cost of the Sagamore, but really completely done funding the Sagamore, at least at the current estimate for that, which is $2.131 billion. Remember, the total for both bridges is $4.5 billion. And the state is still waiting to hear about that big grant, which is over $1 billion. That is from the Bridge Investment Program. But the state says the winners of that should be notified very soon, either later this spring or early summer.
This was a public meeting, meaning that people got a chance to ask questions. What kinds of things did you hear?
Well, some of the big things people asked about were the bridge design itself, the configuration of local roads at the entrance and exits of the bridges, which is still not finalized, the rights of way that the state will be taking, and of course, again, that issue of whether an easier drive over the bridges will bring too much traffic to the Cape. One question I hadn't heard before about the design pointed out that because you have separate spans going on and off the Cape at each bridge, right? Those twin spans they've talked about, there will be more fences in your view as you look across, because each span needs fences, right? So if you're like on the eastern side and you're looking west, you're looking through three layers of fence. So the questioner who was identified there in the Zoom as Phil Goddard, said, why couldn't the bridges be fitted with some kind of connecting piece in between after they're done, to avoid having fences in the center? The answer to that from the design consultant was that that gap allows for the bridges to be inspected using a device called a snooper. Had not heard that term, but it's a truck with an arm that extends around and under the side of the bridge that actually holds the inspectors, the human inspectors, in this big arm, almost like a cherry picker that goes around the side of the bridge. And in order to do that, they need a gap of 15 to 20 feet, he said. Other audience questions. One person asked, what is the state going to do to improve traffic backups on Sandwich Road, down there in front of Cape Tech, Upper Cape Tech in that area? Everyone knows there's a lot of traffic there. The state says they're still looking at options for how to improve traffic control for that intersection by the school.
I think it's interesting that while the long timeline is being blocked out now, there's a much clearer idea of how to get from where we are now to the new bridges. And yet there's still so much more to be decided. They're kind of working with these big concepts, like even the design of the bridge, right? They don't know what it's going to look like, even though they're moving ahead with building it.
Yes, that's true. I mean, they pretty much have settled on the arch shape, and they presented some other details of what they anticipate will be used last night. But that's true. And one of the next big things yet to be settled is what those four interchanges will be, one on each side of the two bridges, what they're going to look like, where they will connect, all of that, because the state needs what's called a preferred alternative. Their top choice, in order to submit their federal documents for that environmental review that we talked about earlier. So the consultant says they're going to be choosing those preferred alternatives for the interchanges in the coming months. And another thing that needs to happen is the gas lines that run over both of the bridges need to be relocated. That is something that is the responsibility of the gas company, but last night at the meeting, the state says that that's considered one of the main risks for a delay right now, actually, because if something happens with the gas, they can't go forward.
We have another meeting coming up in May. I understand it's a different format.
Yes, so the May meeting is set up as an open house. There will not be a presentation or slides or anything like that, but the images and the maps will be set up as display stations. I expect it will be a similar setup to last year. That will be around the room there at the Veterans Memorial Community Center in Bourne. People who attend can have one-on-one conversations with people from DOT and from the design consultants. So that is a good opportunity. Cordero from DOT was really encouraging people last night who have questions about, either their own street or a specific situation to go to that open house to kind of get that individual attention. That's on May 13th. They're in Bourne, and there are actually two sessions for people to accommodate people's schedules, afternoon and evening. We have more details in the most recent Bridge story on our website about getting to that open house. And then we're going to have another story later today.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
The Massachusetts Army National Guard has released a downsized proposal for a machine gun range on Joint Base Cape Cod. It attempts to address concerns about whether the range could contaminate the region's drinking water. But CAI's Eve Zukoff reports that federal officials don't appear convinced. Eve Zukoff joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
Let's cover some basics right here to start. How did we get this new proposal and why is it so important?
Sure. So the Massachusetts Army National Guard has released this new proposal that, as you said, is scaling back its machine gun range project. And they did that because the Environmental Protection Agency released a draft report last year that found the range could contaminate drinking water and create a significant public health threat for hundreds of thousands of year-round residents. Residents on the Cape, along with, of course, millions of visitors. What's interesting is that we now know the Guard and the EPA went back and forth with ideas about what a safe range would look like for years. And the Guard sent this updated proposal to the EPA back in December, but we're only getting this now because our congresspeople, Senator Warren, Markey, and Congressman Keating, they reached out to the EPA and said, look, we want an update on where this machine gun range project stands and your work on it. And the EPA officials wrote a letter back that includes the Guard's plan to make this project more kind of aquifer safe from the Guard's point of view. And of course, the agency has responded to it now. The headline here, as you have already said, is that the EPA is pretty skeptical. And that's important because eventually the EPA will send a recommendation about the project's safety to the EPA's national administrator, that's Michael S. Regan. And Regan has the power to effectively kill the project by denying federal funding.
So what is the Guard saying in this new proposal? How have they scaled it back?
Yeah, the new proposal from the Guard reduces the amount of ammunition from 1.3 million bullets per year to around 800,000, among some other efforts to minimize the environmental impact. The Guard also said that they'd eliminate the area of the range that would be needed to train with the M2 50 caliber machine gun. That's like the big gun, Maduce is often what it's called, colloquially. Instead, this 8-lane range will only support the training on two of the smaller guns that they're building this for. Now, the EPA doesn't bring this up, but it's really important, so I will say this. Without those long lanes, there is a question about why a range is needed on Cape Cod. Because with that design, with this scaled-down design, the proposed range will look a lot like a range that's under construction at Fort Devens in central Mass. The Guard didn't get back to me to address this yet, but I am already hearing lots of criticism from range critics about this very point.
Let's stick with this proposal here and how the EPA is responding to it. What did they say about these scaled-back provisions that the Guard is proposing?
Well, we don't get like a big declaration from the EPA that they're not satisfied, but they point to a lot of specific areas where they remain on a very different page from where the Guard is. So on the point about reducing the number of bullets fired per year from this, you know, 1.3 million to 800,000, EPA officials said, look, this would still triple the number of bullets fired on the base per year. And those bullets would only be collected basically every 10 years, which continues concerns about pollutants reaching the aquifer that's providing Cape Codders with their drinking water. In their letter, EPA officials also said that the Guard's new plan relies on dirt berms as the primary means to contain bullets. The Guard's plan doesn't follow recommendations to recover, these spent munitions as frequently as prescribed. The EPA also says that, you know, by taking a reactive rather than proactive approach, pollution from, you know, these bullets may have already occurred by the time the guard finds anything in its inspection and monitoring plan. And finally, the EPA says that the Guard's initial proposal didn't include comprehensive analyses, studies, or other information that adequately responded to a number of questions and concerns, nor does their new proposal. So the EPA basically runs through this list of reasons why they're not satisfied, and they're just really not seeing eye to eye with the Guard at the moment.
Let's bring listeners into the process on a story like this a little bit. I know that you haven't gotten a chance yet to interview the Guard or the EPA about this. This came yesterday, and it was a document you really had a lot there to sort through. What kinds of questions are on your mind as you look at this?
Oh, my gosh. I've got so many. I sent 10 questions to the Guard, so we won't look at all of those now. But I think the most important one is this. If the range can't accommodate the M2 50 caliber machine gun, won't guardsmen and women still have to travel to Vermont and New York to get that essential training? And if so, why build a machine gun range on Joint Base Cape Cod when a similar range, also without the 50 cal capability, is being built, you know, an hour and a half off Cape? That is kind of like the big question right now. This particular choice to scale down in this way leaves open that big question. And for the EPA, they actually never really answered our congressional delegation's question about the status of their process to evaluate this new proposal. The EPA said that they're still evaluating the Guard's updated proposal. They're having internal conversations. So I would want to ask EPA officials, how much more evaluating until you're ready to finalize your thoughts? There are a lot of areas where you are not on the same page as the Guard, not even close. Are you going to overcome that to be favorable to this machine gun range project? Or is this basically, frankly, a done deal?
We really could talk about this for another 10 minutes.
Yes.
But I want to move on now and talk about another story you covered this week. Local officials are working on a new plan to develop affordable housing that's also climate resilient and made with sustainable materials. What can you tell us about this project?
Yeah, well, there's this group of 9 students that were recruited by the recently launched Massachusetts Housing and Climate Innovation Center, which is going to be on Cape Cod. It's an outgrowth of the Cape Cod Climate Change Collaborative's work. And these students are going to be coming here this summer. They're called All Stars. It's not exactly clear what they'll be doing, but each will be paired up with a local organization and town to do things like develop a plan for a tiny home community, you know, to kind of growing out of what towns already have in mind. Or they could figure out which buildings could best be repurposed into affordable housing units. So basically, this new kind of collaboration will hopefully bring fresh legs, people that are hungry and able to just pour themselves into this work for a summer.
And we've got information on the website.
Yes.
Also, before I let you go, it was Right Whale Day in Massachusetts this week.
It was. And a number of state officials and right whale experts spent the day Wednesday at the New England Aquarium to have this conversation about the plight of right whales. There are about 350 of them left on the planet. Talk about conservation efforts. They had Calvin, this 42-foot-long inflatable right whale, on display. But, you know, for people who are in this every day is Right Whale Day. And for many of them, their attention is elsewhere. There are, you know, I think it was like 25 right whales were seen in Provincetown, in the harbor in Provincetown just this week. So people are busy locally, and there are entangled whales off our coast at the moment. We know there was one seen off Rhode Island just a week ago. So there's a lot of work to do for right whales right now.
That is CAI's Eve Zukoff. Eve, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on the Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Thomas Humphrey of the Vineyard Gazette. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on the Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Chilmark this week held one of its most well-attended town meetings in recent memory. Was there a hot-button topic? You bet. Thomas Humphrey of the Vineyard Gazette is here to catch us up. Hi, Thomas.
Good morning.
Thomas, the big issue that brought folks out has to do with how the Chilmark Community Center is managed and the program that goes on there on the town-owned tennis courts. What can you tell us about what's going on?
Well, it kind of goes back to how those courts are managed. They're not managed directly by the town, but for the last 70 years have been managed by a private nonprofit group called the Chilmark Town Affairs Council. And over the past few years, there has been kind of a bubbling controversy over how the council manages staffing at those tennis courts. And that finally came to the surface at the town meeting this week.
So at town meeting, there was a proposal to separate the management of the tennis courts from the Chilmark Community Center management. Is that right?
Yeah, the initial proposal was a citizen petition, got over 120 signatures, and the original proposal was to establish an independent town tennis committee, which would operate the tennis courts and make it so that Chilmark Town Affairs Council, which operates the summer camp, would not have jurisdiction over those courts.
This has been going on a little while, and this is in part why there was such a big turnout to talk about this. What was the meeting like? Was there a lot of tension there, a lot of people really packed in to talk about this?
Yeah, it was very packed. They had to see people up on the stage of the community center after they ran out of room in the main area. It was definitely tense. There had been a couple of meetings previously to this where the issue had been hashed out and there were some last minute changes, but it was definitely a tense meeting.
In the end, it was a little bit dramatic in that the proposal got changed on the floor of town meeting. Is that right? So people went in there thinking there was going to be one kind of, I don't want to say it's a battle, but one kind of issue at the center of it. And the people who proposed this new tennis oversight committee just kind of pivoted. Okay, I think we may have lost Thomas on the line there. I'm just going to... Oh, Thomas, you still there?
Hello?
Okay, let me see if we can keep you on the line just for a moment to finish this up. Can you tell us what happened at the end of that town meeting?
Yeah, it was one of the leaders of the tennis group pitched a review committee, which will be appointed by the town moderator, to draft a report about the management of the tennis courts, and basically... we will have a decision next year.
So they created a committee that's going to kind of look at this for the next year while all this goes back and forth. You've got a community center that's managed by this nonprofit for the last 70 years. So you can imagine there's a lot of institutional history here as people try to negotiate this. Thomas Humphrey of the Vineyard Gazette, where you can read all about it. Thomas, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Some live radio drama there as we tried to keep him on the line. We're going to turn now to Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Steve.
Tim, the challenges of providing public access to the water kind of bedevil towns all around the region. Chatham has been taking a closer look at how to protect public access. And one of the big challenges in Chatham when it comes to public access to the water is parking and limiting parking in order to help folks who live in the neighborhood. Often turns out to limit access for town residents and others who don't live nearby. Tell us how the town is trying to sort of balance these forces now.
Sure. Well, last year we had an issue in Chatham with the Cowyard Town Landing where neighbors complained about overuse, and the result was restriction on who could use that landing. Basically, during the summer, town residents with stickers on their cars were the only ones allowed to use that. You know, this got some of the folks who work in the waterfront and who develop policy for the waterfront thinking about, you know, how can we further protect some of our town landings? And the South Coastal Harbor Planning Committee recently met with the Waterways Committee to talk about this issue. And the chairman there is worried that, you know, folks with who buy property adjacent to town landings, you know, nowadays those properties are worth millions of dollars, and those people want to protect their privacy and limit use of some of the public facilities. That happened down near Sears Road Town Landing in Chatham earlier this year, where a private property owner installed a guardrail. The guardrail was on town property or on his property, but it was an area that folks who used the landing had been parking on for decades, basically, and this sort of brought the issue to the fore as well. And the committee is, the Harbor Management Committee is looking at maybe instituting some new regulations that would stipulate that property owners who live next to town landings would not be allowed to install things like that guardrail that would limit the use of town landings. And they're even suggesting possible eminent domain takings of nearby properties to protect town landings. And, you know, these are both these issues have come up in the past in Chatham, and they've been problematic. You know, anytime you talk about eminent domain, you get into a big issue of, how much is it going to cost? What kind of liability is the town going to have, et cetera, et cetera. And officials are also worried about, if the town's ability to restrict what private properties do on their properties, even if they're adjacent to a public town landing. Right now, as things stand, the town has the ability to remove obstacles that might be placed on town property at landings where that impede public access. Ted Keon, our coastal resources director here in Chatham, noted that a few years ago, a neighbor put a fence across the end of a town landing, and the town basically went in and took it down because it wasn't allowed. Mm. It was impeding access. And, the committees understand that there are some legal hurdles there, but they want to raise this issue because they're basically concerned that these, the escalating property values and people's insistence on privacy are going to further impact the public's right to get to the waters, which, as we know, are already limited throughout the Cape.
Tim, let me ask you about another story in the paper this week. It's a lighter story. It's a profile of a dog in the Brewster Animal Shelter. It's a story with a happy ending. Tell us about this dog, Biscuit, and why you showcased him.
Sure. Biscuit is a black lab mix. He's 4 months old. And what made his case interesting was that Biscuit is originally from Mississippi. And as a young puppy, a neighbor apparently was firing off a gun, and it grazed Biscuit. It created a crease on his forehead that you can see in photos of the dog we have on our website. He was injured, but he wasn't it wasn't a life threatening injury. But it just brought up to us the need for people to take care of these animals. And it also showcased something that the Animal Rescue League of Boston, which has a Brewster shelter, which is where Biscuit ended up. They work closely with the American Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals to relocate pets like Biscuit that are abused or injured or just caught up in overcrowded shelters. Mm. And these are mostly in the South, frankly, and bring them up to areas like the Cape, where they can find a home. And as you said, this story had a happy ending. Biscuit has been has found a home and is apparently happy, according to the Animal Rescue League. He's doing well, and luckily this story has a happy ending. Hopefully by highlighting this, we can show people that going to the Animal Rescue League, mm-hmm, is a great way to adopt a pet who might not otherwise have a chance at a happy life.
Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, where you can see a picture of Biscuit. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
We hear a lot of talk about affordable housing on Cape Cod. But what is it really? How does it work? Why isn't it easier to create more of it? Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent joins us to talk about this. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Steve. How you doing?
Paul, I learned a lot from your piece in the paper. You talked to a housing expert about the Cape's specific issues, with really a focus on the Outer Cape, because as you say here, spring is the season for town meetings, and these days housing is a big topic. Tell us who you talked to, and then we can kind of get into some of the nuts and bolts of what she told you.
Laura Schufelt is, talking to her is like a mind-expanding experience. She has so much experience in affordable housing. She's from Cape Cod. She now works for the state at the Massachusetts Housing Partnership, and one of her jobs is to help towns specifically write their requests for these projects so that they're realistic, so that they're buildable with all of the federal and state money and the very complex strings that are attached to all of that money.
Mm. One of the questions you asked her off the top is, what is affordable? What does that mean for people, especially on Cape Cod?
It's interesting. It actually goes back to Senator Edward Brooke, Massachusetts' senator in the 70s, who came up with the affordability standard, put it into law. And back then it was 25% of your income was supposed to go to housing. It's been raised since then to 30%. But in these affordable projects, they're basically, the rules are written for each different kind of unit in the building, that 30% of the tenant's income is what's going to housing. broadly speaking. And that's a standard that a lot of the state has blown right past. You know, many, many people are paying huge chunks of their income, up to 50% on housing costs, especially out here in places like Provincetown and Truro and Wellfleet.
So roughly 30% of a person's income, if they're renting one of these affordable housing units, should go towards covering housing and utilities. Is that right?
That is correct, yeah.
And as you say, there's kind of a different, you kind of point to the fact that there's also a different, this applies to homeowners as well, but a little bit differently.
It does. So when you have affordable ownership units, which are also by lottery, and usually 10 or 12 or 14 people apply, and you have a mortgage that's written for a much lower number than the market, that would be that same 30% standard that defines that.
You also ask about who gets to live in affordable housing. We hear a lot of discussion about local workers not being able to find year-round housing. How much of this affordable housing can be directed at a certain local population?
This is part of why we wrote the article, because a lot of misinformation tends to swirl about local preference. And we were getting concerned people sending us letters or things they were seeing that said, oh, it's only going to be 25%. You know, it's going to be all these people from Metro Boston moving here. We're going to spend all this money building it and it won't even be for us. And that is simply not true. Laura was able to explain exactly how the system works. On Cape Cod, where the housing crisis is extremely acute, you can get 70% of the units reserved outright for local people. Most of the other 30%, which is sort of a second lottery, everyone who's in the first lottery pool of local people is also added to the second lottery pool for the other 30% of units. And she said, when you look at actual lotteries that have been done lately, the vast majority, in the case of one in Hyannis, it was 77 out of 80 applicants were living on Cape Cod. So the actual practice of this is that people who live here are the ones who are applying for these units.
So the formula is complicated, as you say, but the way the whole process is working out, it really is supporting affordable housing for people who live on the Cape. One of the other things you asked her is why it takes so long to build affordable housing.
Yes, and that's another one. So the best case scenario is about 5 years, which involves going through the bidding process, going through zoning, getting your permits, getting your financing lined up, and then about 2 years, maybe 18 months of construction. But that is frequently doubled in practice by about a five-year process beforehand, 1 to 5 years, of talking with the community, having a series of meetings, having special committees form, having really extended debates that can be productive, or they can kind of go sideways to reality if there's no one in the room who understands how the money works and what you can actually get paid for. Someone used the expression, a unicorn plan, where, you know, everyone's talking about a swimming pool without realizing that there's no federal money for swimming pools, and that's a $30 million project if that's what you land on.
Mm. It's a fascinating article in the Provincetown Independent with lots more information in there. And as I say, I learned a lot reading this that I didn't know about the ins and outs of how affordable housing gets put together on the Cape. Paul Benson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. A federal court has dismissed an appeal by a group of Nantucket residents aimed at stopping the Vineyard Wind offshore wind energy project. Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current has details on this story and joins us. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
This was a three-judge panel that heard the appeal. The group wanted to stop offshore wind development, they say, to protect right whales. Now, what did the judges say?
Yeah, this has been a case that's been ongoing for more than a year, brought by a group of Nantucket residents known as ACK4Whales, challenging specifically the permitting and that was done at the federal level for the Vineyard Wind Project, which is the first major offshore wind development. We've all been watching the turbines go up off the southwest coast of the island. And ACK4Whales has been calling out Vineyard Wind, you know, from the start and challenged their the permitting process that happened with the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, saying that it had violated the National Environmental Policy Act, and that the project was going to jeopardize the viability of the critically endangered North Atlantic right whales, which we've obviously has been a topic on CAI, and we've been watching very closely this endangered species, and the debate has been sort of raging about what the impact of these wind farms will be on that species. But as you said, the three-judge panel in federal court rejected those arguments this week and said that the process, you know, was adequate and that all of the sort of analysis was rationally supported. And the conclusion that those federal agencies came to, that the Vineyard Wind is not likely to jeopardize the existence of the right whale. So those judges affirmed the previous decision by the district court judge, which had similarly dismissed the lawsuit brought by Act for Whales. And this lawsuit, at least, you know, talking to the folks at Act for Whales yesterday, is not going away. They've actually vowed to take this up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, that's, you know, what the group wants to do, whether the Supreme Court would even hear this case. It's a very high bar, obviously, to get that in front of the highest court in the country. But Act for Whales, you know, vowing to continue taking this forward, even as Vineyard Wind is, you know, we've seen 10 to 11 turbines going up off the coast of Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard.
We've at the station, we've done a lot of reporting on right whales, and we know that really the thing that's driving them to extinction are these human impacts of entanglement and fishing gear and ship strikes, and that the wind construction companies so far have appeared responsive to all the regulations imposed on them to minimize their risk of impact on right whales. And so far, no known deaths or injuries to whales attributed to them as they've been building the wind farms offshore. So a lot of attention on this effort to build wind and also to do it in an area that obviously is very environmentally sensitive. Hey, I want to ask you about Daffodil Weekend that's kicking off. This is a rite of spring on the island. Can you describe the transformation of downtown and tell us what events are in store?
Oh, yeah, sure. So obviously this is the annual sort of start to the season for Nantucket, the sort of kickoff after a, you know, usually quiet winter and early spring. So the 48th annual Daffodil Festival is underway. It's all the businesses and stores and restaurants have got back open downtown and across the island. Visitors are expected. The boats are full. You know, the some of the High Line has already said that the boats have been filled up and sold out. And, you know, the sort of signature events that are put on by the Nantucket Chamber of Commerce, the antique car parade will start tomorrow on Main Street. And then the parade heads out to Sconset, where there's a tailgate and a celebration of the season. And, of course, the millions of daffodils blooming all over the island are looking good. And so the island is in a festive state for the weekend and expecting a lot of visitors and a lot of commerce and sort of kick off to the start of the season out here on Nantucket.
And some decent spring weather, which is not always the case.
That's true. We're looking, anytime we get a, you know, we had a freeze overnight, but it's the sun is out, and yeah, it looks like we'll have good weather for the weekend.
That is Jason Grazide at Nantucket Current. Jason, thanks.
Thanks for having me on.
It's been a busy week on Beacon Hill as state lawmakers are debating a proposed $58 billion state budget for the fiscal year beginning in July. Our State House correspondent Katie Lannon spoke with CAI's Dan Tridle about all the activity at the State House. Here's their conversation.
Hey, good morning.
So the House has been busy with budget issues all week. What's the latest?
So the House is debating, still working its way through this big $58 billion annual budget. So far, they've added about $26 million in new spending through the amendment process, which every year the budget grows by about $100 million as they add on these amendments. But it's notable this year because there's been such a stress on the need for fiscal responsibility at the time when the state faces a tight revenue picture. A lot of these amendments added on so far are earmarks for local programs, including so far $25,000 for Dennis Yarmouth Regional High School, $100,000 for the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole. So we expect to see that bottom line continue to grow, and we're watching to see what kind of situation the state might end up in financially.
And what about funding and measures to house all the migrants that have come to Massachusetts? Lawmakers have been wrestling with this issue for some time.
Yeah, and the soaring price tag to house all the new migrants who are here, along with other homeless Massachusetts residents, has been really contributed to this financial squeeze. As of just Wednesday night, the House and Senate, after weeks of back and forth behind closed doors, agreed on a bill that will pour more money into the shelter system for both this fiscal year and the new one that starts in July. That also caps most families' shelter stays at 9 months, although there'll be a situation where certain shelter residents can request extensions or hardship waivers to be there longer. And the goal that state lawmakers have with putting on that cap is making sure that shelter program is a transitional one, that people aren't staying there long term, and to help get a handle on those costs. Of course, there are questions from advocates on what will happen to people who are no longer eligible to stay in shelter and where will they go.
Meantime, the state Senate president wants community colleges to be free for Massachusetts residents. This seems like an ambitious plan. Tell us more about this.
Absolutely. It's ambitious. It's pegged to cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 million. And it would build on something lawmakers and Governor Healey did in last year's state budget when they made community college free for adults over 25 without degrees and for nursing students. So the Senate President, Karen Spilka, wants to go bigger. She wants to make it universally free. It's not clear, given the tight revenue picture, if the governor and the House will go along with that plan, though.
Okay. You also mentioned that lawmakers are dealing with child care issues on Beacon Hill. What's happening there?
Yeah, the cost and availability of child care has been something we've heard a lot about from lawmakers, and it's something that is another focus in the budget debate. And Senate President Spilka wants to start a new partnership program with businesses where the state would provide matching funds to employers who work to create new childcare seats so that their employees have somewhere their kids can go. That happened in Iowa, and it'll be interesting to see if that does ultimately come to fruition here in Massachusetts.
Covering the State House is a challenging issue. Katie Lannon does it with ease. Katie, thanks, and I appreciate all your time.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And that is CAI's Dan Tridle speaking with our State House correspondent, Katie Lannon. You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. It's been a year since the city of New Bedford launched a landmark housing plan. Grace Ferguson of the New Bedford Light is with us to lay out the progress and what could still be to come. Hi, Grace.
Hi, Steve.
Grace, you report that nearly 200 new housing units are already under construction or were recently completed, which seems like a significant number, but the goal is even bigger here, huh?
Yeah, I mean, just the number of housing units in the city's pipeline is significant at this point. You've mentioned that 200 units that are either close to finishing up or have already come onto the market, but we actually have a total of more than 700 units somewhere in the pipeline. More than half of those are in early stages of development, and that's kind of the result of this big push that the city had as part of its housing plan, which was to court developers and recruit them and get them to come to the city.
Well, tell us about that plan and what it's trying to address and really the overall vision that it's laying out here.
Yeah, I mean, the Building New Bedford plan, which came out in March of last year, really tried to address the sort of upside down economics of building housing in New Bedford. Construction costs are about the same across all of New England, but rents are comparatively pretty low in New Bedford. And so developers tend to look to other places where they can get a higher return on their investment. So the idea behind the Building New Bedford plan was to get those developers to come here by taking a really hands-on approach. So the city's met with about 60 different developers in one-on-one meetings where they walk them through anywhere from picking sites to figuring out the financing of the project, all the way through to getting it permitted.
You say there's about 700 units sort of in various stages of development, but even so, that falls well short of the identified need for housing within the city.
That's true. There was a report that came out earlier this year from the Regeneration Committee of New Bedford's Economic Development Council, and that report found that right now, New Bedford needs more than 4,000 housing units in its housing stock just to address the current need. And by the end of the decade, we're going to need almost 9,000 new housing units in Greater New Bedford to address the growing need that we expect in that time.
That's a lot of new housing units. So the city's really leaning in to build more housing. Explain some of the things that they're doing to try to create an atmosphere where this can happen.
Yeah, so in addition to, like I mentioned, talking to developers, the city's really trying to streamline its permitting process. And so the housing office is sitting in on pre-permitting meetings where all the different departments come together and sort of walk a developer through what they may need permits for. Other parts of the plan address using spaces that we already have. So there's a vacant building initiative that the plan just started. They just recently hired someone whose sole job it is just to get vacant buildings back on track. The city's pouring a bunch of money into first-time home buyer programs and programs to help people stay in their homes, as well as more money for homeless prevention and programs to address homelessness. And the city's also working on some zoning reform. So it's a huge plan with a whole bunch of different strategies in various areas.
Is there a sense that it's really making some significant change, that it's sort of steering the ship in a new direction here?
Definitely on the development front, the city has been touting that more than 700 units. I did talk to Shane Burgo, who chairs the city council's affordable housing committee. He had hoped that the city would have thousands of units in the pipeline, not just hundreds. And he was also getting very impatient with the city in terms of the zoning reforms. The city hasn't presented any of the zoning reforms that it had in the plan to the council yet, and he had hoped to see those sooner. Those reforms would affect lot size requirements, parking requirements. Basically, the idea is that they would make it easier to build denser housing in the city.
And how about the idea that the city is not isolated, that there's the surrounding towns also have to play a part in this?
Yeah, one part of the plan called for a more regional approach. Of course, the housing crisis doesn't just affect New Bedford. It affects Dartmouth, Fairhaven, Acushnet, all the towns around. There's not really a lot the city can do to force those towns to build more housing. There's no mechanism for that. But I talked to the city's housing developer. He said he's had some good conversations with leaders in the other towns. And there's also a housing symposium, a summit for all the housing leaders in the area coming up on Tuesday.
I'm just curious, as you're in and around New Bedford and, you know, just going about your daily life, do you get a sense of this effort underway on the streets? I know there's empty buildings that they've identified that they're rehabbing into housing. Is there a sense of the construction going on or development going on?
I think there is. You know, there's this big empty lot on Union Street, the Keystone lot, that hasn't had any building on it in almost 20 years, I think. And that lot is just about to get a new 45-unit apartment building. That was just announced very recently. You walk down Union Street, and there's actually multiple construction sites. And so you are starting to see some of this construction actually start to happen, which is really exciting.
It's Grace Ferguson of the New Bedford Light. Grace, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
That is our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff. We spoke with Thomas Humphrey at the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, checked in with Paul Benson at the Provincetown Independent and Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current. CAI's Dan Tridle spoke with our State House reporter Katie Lannon, and we heard there from Grace Ferguson of the New Bedford Light. Big thanks to Dan Tridle for engineering the program. If the news roundup is a demolition derby, Dan Tridle shows up driving the monster truck. Thanks for listening in Woods Hole. I'm Steve Junker. We'll talk to you next week.